Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. On our last program, we began to discuss that Lawrence's desire to be a hero came true in the Middle East. We called that program the Lawrence Cult, and certainly he became a cult hero. Now, he did have great triumphs. He had huge challenges, but he also had some incredible failures. Now, he did not achieve his ultimate goal for the Arabs, and eventually he did resign from his duties in the Middle East. But the Middle East was really not done with him, or maybe I should say he really wasn't done with the Middle East. Well, today, what I wanted to discuss with you is the fact that the Lawrence legend did live on, and in fact, it's still living on today. Now, I want to encourage you to finish this book. There is a lot of history there to understand, and we have to really recognize that Lawrence really did inspire a lot of people. And again, I just maybe want to bring up a few things. He did have, let's say, a real military genius, and he was really ahead of his time. And Quitter brings this out on page 357 of his book. And I think it's important that we understand this. Now, I'm also going to talk in this program about, Lawrence and Churchill finally connected up, and it was the two of them together that really, did the diplomacy to build the Middle East into what it was today. But I think the thing is, we have to see that Lawrence was ahead of his time, and also Churchill was ahead of his time. And let me just read this to you. This is towards the bottom of page 357. It says, Lawrence was in a position to ask for more mountain guns, camels, automatic weapons, and money. In addition, he requested and got the support of Joyce's armored cars and a fleet of Rolls-Royce tenders to support them. In his raid from Aqaba to Mudawara to attack the station there, he had embarked on how much of the desert consisted of smooth, flat, baked mud, and it seemed to him that a car could be driven across it at high speed, so that as the Arab forces advanced into Syria, the cars would give him vastly increased mobility and firepower. So in some ways, he was really like Churchill in this way. Listen to this. This is bottom of page 359. He was able to take these Rolls Royces, put machine guns on them, and make them tanks. And so he was really thinking ahead. And this is what Quarter says about this, bottom of page 359. It says, Lawrence was, in the words of Liddell Hart, at least a generation ahead of the military world in perceiving the strategic implications of mechanized warfare and putting it into effect. Henceforth, cars and trucks began to play almost as important a role in Lawrence's plans as camel or horse-mounted Bedouin. And when he finally arrived in Damascus, it would be in his own personal Rolls-Royce tender, which he named Blue Mist, seated next to a British Army Service Corps driver and surrounded by his own colorful bodyguard. And so Lawrence really, really was ahead of his time, just like, Churchill was. Churchill wanted to develop tanks, and they made fun of him. But, tanks are very successful. Again, we don't want to just talk about all of his failures. I want you to read on your own. He did have his big success at the Battle of Tafalla. And even Korda compares that to the Battle of Gettysburg. And you can read that on page 367 and page 373. And if you understand anything about this, is the Arabs could not be relied upon to take a place and hold it. They were very qualified to do guerrilla raids. And, of course, Lawrence wanted to prove that they could do it. And so they did. They took this town of Tafalla, And again, Korda compares it to the Battle of Gettysburg, but it's almost like Lawrence represented the South and the South won instead of the North winning in Gettysburg. But there was one thing that we have to understand kind of after this. I want to go to page 375 to pick this up. I think this is an important thing we have to realize about heroes and about Lawrence is that this effort that he was going through was really taking its toll on Lawrence. And, you know, he was really being worn down. Of course, he was, you know, he was brutalized and really, you know, beaten in Dara. And so, you know, it's almost like he suffered PTSD after that. And, you know, he could not, or maybe it should be PTSD. Excuse me if I got that wrong. But notice what Korda says on page 375. There was something else that happened. Working with the Arabs was not easy. And Korda really had to fight through that. He said he spent 3 days with Joyce, Donnie, and Faisal, then set off back to Tafila with an escort provided by Faisal. Lawrence split the gold into coins into 30 canvas bags, each bag containing 1,000 gold sovereigns. Two of these bags could be carried by a single camel. Even this was a heavy burden on the poor beast. With the ice and frozen mud and his return journey to Tafila was as cold and difficult as the journey down. Once there, he found waiting for him a young British intelligence officer, Kirkbride, a taciturn and enduring fellow, and leaving the gold in Zaid's care, he rode to Dana with the young man, then rode north on a reconnaissance mission of his own as far as the edge of the Jordan Valley, from where he could hear Allenby's guns attacking Jericho. It seemed to Lawrence feasible to bring the Arab army north of the Dead Sea, as he had promised, and he rode back to give Zaid the good news, only to find that Zaid, shamefaced, had been persuaded or browbeaten by the local sheiks to pay them the gold Lawrence had brought from Gera. Of the 30,000 in gold coins, he had nothing left. So the plan of advancing north was impossible. Now, can you imagine? Here's Lawrence's plan all along has been to, you know, bring the Arabs into Damascus and give them their shot, and it was blown. They needed the gold to be able to you know, to keep the Arabs in tow. And, you know, it was just devastating to Lawrence. Korda says, Lawrence's reaction was very like a nervous breakdown. He was aghast and realized at once that this meant the complete ruin of my plans and hopes. And so he at that point, he was just ready to resign. And, of course, you know that Allenby and Clayton and his military, you know, leaders were not going to let him resign. But I'll tell you what, he was just broken, not only by what happened to him at Dira, but then just working with the Arabs. I mean, it's almost like he had to begin to realize that the Arabs weren't just qualified to go in and take Syria and then rule it by themselves. There's some interesting things that, you know, we could read on that. You could skip all the way ahead to page 435. And I'll just read this one paragraph to you. And the thing is, you can really understand how, you know, Lawrence would really, you know, become so discouraged by all this. It says, in essence, this was the feeling that would motivate Lawrence throughout the rest of his life. The belief not just that he had failed the Arabs by not getting the state and the independence they had fought for, but that he was rendered by what he had done, seen, and experienced permanently unclean, unfit for the society of decent people, a kind of moral leper. It is important to realize that while Lawrence's behavior after the war seems strange to many people, it is not at all unfamiliar to those who have fought in a war. And so again, you know, we have to have some compassion on the man. And, you know, he began to see, you know, that things were not going to be easy as he thought they maybe, could have been. All right, so that kind of brings us up to date where we need to be. Now, I want to go to page 493, and I want to talk to you about this documentary film. And Thomas's film really, really hit the public in such a great way that I think it was totally unexpected by Lawrence and by a lot of other people. But here's we have to kind of see this for what it is and what was really going on in the world at the time. It says, this is the middle of page 493. It says, although Lawrence had been criticized for cooperating with Thomas, he could hardly have foreseen that a documentary film would fill London's biggest halls and theaters to capacity six nights a week and two matinees, let alone that the Metropolitan Police would have to be called out in force night after night to handle the huge crowds. And it says, Thomas had not only put Arabia on the map, but made T.E. Lawrence a perennial celebrity. The normally staid Daily Telegraph summed it up nicely. Thomas Lawrence, the archaeologist, went out to Arabia and practically unaided raised for the first time almost since history began a great homogeneous Arab army. The Telegraph predicted that thanks to Thomas, the name Lawrence will go down to remotest posterity besides the names of a half dozen men who dominate history. And so the point is, we have to see that really, I still think today with Korda's book, the Lawrence legend lives on. And I have to admit to you, this is one of the most inspiring books that I've ever read. But it also, like I said to you earlier, it's just chocked full of history. And we don't want to miss the history. And again, there's just, like I said, we've almost finished half the book, but there's almost another half a book to read. And so I'm going to have you, finish this on your own. Now, one of the things that I wanted to say is that as much as Lawrence got discouraged, and I guess I really I want to talk about that. I think I have this for a little bit later. Maybe I missed this in my notes. But the thing is he did go from warrior to diplomat, and he did work with David Lloyd George, and he worked with Winston Churchill. There's some of that on page 509. And I think I meant to put this in my notes, and I'll just mention it to you. You have to remember that when all these things began to happen and when Lawrence lost the gold, he could not take Damascus, and it was going to have to be up to the British Army. And when the British Army did take it, and essentially the Arabs got in there, and they could not get along. And Lawrence was asked to come in. He drove the blue mist into Damascus, and when he got there, the Arab tribes were all in one room together, and they were fighting each other, about ready to kill each other. And he just was discouraged and realized that they were never going to be able to do this on their own. And, of course, then it was revealed to them about the Sykes-Picot Agreement, and that the Sykes-Picot Agreement was in, that France was going to be over Syria. And, it really turned out that it was going to be a really bad situation. Anyway, Lawrence just realized that, all the things he had hoped for and strove for were not just going to happen. And so, he did resign. But I want to now just go to page 509, just to show you that he wasn't done with the Middle East, even though he did return home for a while. This is page 509, says he was in fact about to embark on one of the most important adventures of his life, one that would in many ways shape the Middle East as we know it today. So Lawrence became a diplomat, and he still had his hands in it. One of the things that I've talked to you many, many times on the program about, Lawrence being a military genius. Well, let me just show you what Basil Little Hart wrote about him. This is on page 515. says in his book about Lawrence, the military historian Basil Little Hart wrote, "Lawrence can bear comparison with Napoleon in the vital faculty of generalship, the power of grasping instantly the picture of the ground and situation, of relating the one to the other. He generated, too, the same electric current of command." While this is high praise coming from such a distinguished critic of strategy, what Little Hart did not point out was that Lawrence's genius for diplomacy and politics was, if anything, more striking. He anticipated by more than 50 years Henry Kissinger's shuttle diplomacy, using aircraft to fly from one leader to another throughout the Middle East in intensive bursts of negotiation and persuasion, restlessly pursuing consensus before second thoughts had time to sink in among his interlocutors. It was not just that he was a young man in a hurry. He was perhaps the first person to appreciate that speed in diplomacy was, as in warfare, was a vital weapon, and that keeping up the pressure was the best way to produce agreement. And so here, not only was he like a modern Napoleon in his military genius, he was like a Henry Kissinger in using, you know, shuttle diplomacy. Now I want to just slip over to page 516 and just to show you how Corder records what he would have done during his shuttle diplomacy. So this was when he was working. I mean, I think once you read the book, you'll find that, Syria exploded. The Syrians were rebelling against the French. And it's really, if you look into that history, it's not any different than what happens today. You know, the fighting started, the fighting among the tribes. They're still fighting among the tribes, even in the Middle East today. I mean, here you have Iran, attacking Saudi Arabia. I mean, it just goes on. But listen, this is what Corder says about, Lawrence. And again, this is really kind of like another phase of the Lawrence legend. "The velocity of his movements through the Middle East is as astonishing even today, particularly when one keeps in mind that air travel then involves sitting in the open cockpit of a biplane and landing on the RAF's improvised dusty airstrips in the desert. A quick glance at Lawrence's journey is revealing. On February 16, 1921, he had a further meeting with Faisal to discuss Iraq and Transjordan. On February 18, he joined the Colonial Office and, together with Young, drew up the agenda for the Cairo meeting. On March 2, he left for Egypt. On March 12, the meeting began there at the Semiramis Hotel in Cairo. The next day, Churchill sought the cabinet's approval to offer the throne of Iraq to Faisal on terms discussed between him and Lawrence. On March 24th, Lawrence cabled Faisal to leave London for Mecca by the quickest possible route, then left Cairo to meet with Abdullah in Amman. On March 9th, he arrived in Jerusalem. On April 21st, he flew to Cairo to meet Faisal, and by May 11th was back in London. He spent the summer and autumn going back and forth on critical diplomatic missions to King Hussein in Jeddah, to Abdullah in Amman, and to the Imam of Yemen." And this is the Lawrence that we know. And now, instead of, trying to unite the Arab tribes, he's trying to work with them as a diplomat. And so he really was an incredible guy. Now, I want to go to page 533, and I want to read you, the impact that Lawrence had on the Middle East. And again, I'm leaping to the back of the book to spur you on, to read this book. All right. Now, here's what Corder writes here about his diplomacy. It says, "Lawrence was only 33 when he returned to Britain at the end of 1921. With only 2 months left of the year, he promised Churchill. He had won the approval of everyone, even Curzon. He had been instrumental in the creation of two Arab nations. He had helped to secure Britain's presence in the Middle East. He had accomplished more in a year than anybody, even Churchill, could have expected, and there is no doubt that a great career of some sort was his for the taking. He could, for that matter, have returned to Oxford. All Souls was used as celebrity fellows who maintained a separate and successful career in politics and government in the great world outside Oxford, and Lawrence's friend Lionel Curtis was one of them. A life as a diplomat, an advisor to the government on the Middle East, an Oxford academic, and an author was open to Lawrence, not only open but expected of him. He had already made up his mind, however, to go into a very different direction and to take the steps that would put an end not to just Colonel Lawrence, but to T.E. Lawrence himself. As with a stage magician at the end of an amazing performance, his last and most remarkable trick would be to vanish from the stage as the curtain began to fall. And so what Korda is referring to there is that Lawrence, he changed his name, and he went into the Royal Air Force. And so he tried to become totally in the limelight, which he actually eventually got discovered anyway. That's another chapter for you to read. That's chapter 11. Now, to me, his most, let's say, disturbing exit and probably maybe the most surprising exit was when he died. So I want to go to page 677 now, and again, this is really, there's been a lot of controversy over, you know, how he died, and we'll read about this here in just a second. But remember I read you earlier about he, even when he was in the Middle East, he kind of lived carelessly. Well, I think you know, he did love dangerous things, and of course he loved his motorcycles, and he was killed in a motorcycle accident. But here's what Korda has to say about this. This is page 677. And again, I think this again is very inspiring reading. I don't know if I agree with everything Korda says, but I still think it's worth reading. It says, probably no vehicle accident up until Princess Diana has received more detailed scrutiny than Lawrence's. His death has been variously ascribed to a foreign or domestic assassination or to some combination of a death wish and speed or suicide. And, I mean, Lawrence really did have, even when he was doing the shuttle diplomacy, I mean, there was still the opportunity to prepare for, you know, potential war and conflict. And a lot of these plans he had in his head, they weren't written down yet. It's true, Lawrence had written, in speed, we hurl ourselves beyond the body. And he loved riding at high speeds, but it was subsequently established that he was going less than 40 miles an hour when he was killed. So he was neither a victim of high-speed driving nor of a successful suicide. As for the assassination theory, there seems no very good reason why either the British or the German intelligence service would have wanted Lawrence dead. Although the Daily Express would claim that he carried the plans for the defense of England in his head, that too seems a typical Fleet Street exaggeration. Certainly Lawrence had ideas on the subject, but he was not privy to any secrets. Though nobody said so at the inquest, his death was yet another proof that a motorcycle accident at any speed is dangerous. The helmets of the day were not scientifically designed to prevent head injury, and in any case, Lawrence never wore a proper helmet. In extremely bad weather, he sometimes wore a leather flying helmet, which would have offered no protection from impact. If he had landed on his side, he might have suffered nothing worse than a few broken bones, but he was thrown forward and instead landed on his head, fracturing the skull. And so there, Korda mentions that, you know, he may have had plans for the defense of England for World War II. So hopefully I didn't speak out of turn on that issue. So anyway, Korda goes on to say, the subsequent inquest and many further investigations by private individuals did not provide much more than this in the way of fact. A soldier, Corporal Catchpole, who heard the crash and ran to the site of the accident, claimed to have seen a black car speeding away from the scene. The boys denied that they were riding side by side, no doubt warned by their parents not to admit that they had been breaking the law, though they were notorious for larking about on the road, and some people have speculated that the front brake cable in Lawrence's brow and that's B-R-O-U-G-H, so that's the name of the motorcycle, may have snapped, although this seems unlikely. Lawrence was always conscious to point of fussiness about maintaining his bikes. Catchpole flagged down a passing army lorry and ordered the driver to take Lawrence and one of the boys who had sustained minor injuries to the Bovington Camp Hospital, the nearest medical facility, where Lawrence was quickly identified. After the army took control, although Lawrence was a civilian and the accident had taken place on a civilian road, all ranks were warned they were not to talk to newspapermen and reminded that they were subject to the Official Secrets Act. Newspaper editors were informed that bulletins about Lawrence's health would be issued by the War Office. All right, so I'm going to skip down a little bit further now. It says, everything that could be done was done, given the limited facilities of the Bovington Camp Hospital. But as the doctors had concluded after examining Lawrence, the case was hopeless. Lawrence lingered 6 days, never regaining consciousness, with his lungs becoming increasingly congested, and died just after 8 a.m. on Sunday, May 19th. He was 46 years old. And Winston Churchill said that if Lawrence hadn't died, he believed that they could have won World War II much faster than they did. So there are many remembrances at the end of this pages 680, 681, and the title of that chapter is Apotheosis. And I think it'd be good for you to take some time and read those. Here's the one by the King. It says, the King has heard with sincere regret the death of your brother and deeply sympathizes with you and your family in this sad loss. So he was writing that to Arnold Lawrence. Your brother's name will live in history, and the King gratefully recognizes his distinguished services to his country and feels that it is tragic that the end should have come in this manner to a life so full of promise. So I think that is what we want to remember about him, is that Lawrence will always be remembered in history, and certainly he did accomplish a lot. Now, I think it's interesting to read what's on his tombstone, and this is on page 61. It says, his plain, modest headstone merely describes him as T.E. Lawrence, Fellow of All Souls College. But here's the scripture that he had put on his tombstone. It says, the hour is coming, and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that hear shall live. And so, I think everyone at least everyone around Herb W. Armstrong College, we're all looking forward to return of Jesus Christ and that first resurrection. And we know that there's three resurrections, there's a second and a third. And so certainly I think Lawrence did have some religious belief. It may not have been absolutely accurate, but he still had some. So that's our final program now on Lawrence. And remember, the Lawrence legend lives on. If you finish the book, certainly the Lawrence legend will live on for you as well. So that's all the time we have for today's program. Next time we'll begin our next series, A Tribute to Charles Krauthammer. We will be reading selected portions of his book of essays titled Things That Matter. Now, you can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. Please write me any comments you may have to jbel@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.